The headlines, the leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement says Biden's regional visit is aimed at getting Arab states to increase their oil production amid U.S.'s indirect war with Russia. The Palestinian resistance group Hamas condemns U.S. president's remarks as full support for the Israeli regime. And inflation in the United States jumped again in June, notching another 40-year high. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. The leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement says U.S. President Joe Biden's West Asia visit is aimed at convincing Arab states to boost their oil production as part of Washington's anti-Russia measures. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah said the U.S. administration wants regional Arab states to supply energy to Europe so the West would be able to cut off energy imports from Russia. He said the U.S. means to reduce Russia's oil and gas revenues amid Washington's indirect war against Moscow in Ukraine. Nasrallah also touched upon Hezbollah's recent dispatch of three unarmed drones to a Mediterranean gas field, which is disputed with Israel. He said the operation was aimed at showing that the Karish field is not safe for gas extraction operations.
We want the Israelis to take it down because we want their fighter jets to go up and go and shell rockets. We want them to hit their rockets. We want their rockets to come. We want fire to begin in their region in order for that ship and the engineers on that ship, on all those people on that ship, to know that they are working in a place which is not safe, that there is a true threat in that area.
Nasrallah said the drone operation was just a humble start, adding that a new formula is coming. He said if Lebanon is barred from maritime gas extraction, no one will be allowed to extract gas and oil, and no one will be able to sell gas or oil. The Hezbollah leader emphasized that the movement is able to hamper Israeli efforts to extract oil and gas from the Karish field. Nasrallah warned that Hezbollah is ready to take necessary military measures to protect Lebanon's rights. Nasrallah said Lebanon has a golden opportunity in the next 2 months to secure its maritime rights before the Israeli regime completes work at Karish. He urged Lebanese officials to use the movement as leverage in their maritime demarcation talks, saying Hezbollah is Lebanon's only strong point. Earlier, we were joined by our Beirut correspondent, Mariam Saleh, who gave us a roundup on the Hezbollah Secretary General's remarks about the Karish oil field dispute with Israel.
Sayed Nasrallah has basically uncovered the plans of the United States. He's uncovered what is happening behind the closed doors, what is happening behind all these talks, and the so back and forth envoys of the U.S. coming to Lebanon for the issue of the so-called demarcation. That the main issue is the fact that the Americans need to provide petrol and gas to the Europeans. And they're striving for the fact that the Israelis provide that gas, provide that petrol, and leave Lebanon in that state of chaos, a state of economic collapse, let it undergo a state where they could not even provide 1 hour of electricity, which the Americans had promised. They had promised 1 year ago that they would give Lebanon an exception from the CSAR Act in order to be given gas from Egypt through Jordan, also through Syria, to have several hours of electricity. That has not been realized because he said that the main project is to put Lebanon in chaos, in addition to prohibiting Lebanon from drilling and extracting its own natural resources. So what we have here is the leader of the resistance basically saying that the resistance is ready to even start a war, not just be ready to deter the Israelis from any sort of invasion, or even to be ready to stop Israeli threats. They are actually ready to even start a war in order for Lebanon to extract its rights.
The Palestinian Resistance Front says U.S. President Joe Biden's remarks upon arrival in Tel Aviv emphasize his support for the Israeli regime. According to Hamas spokesman Hazem Qasem, Biden's statements are in line with the criminal intentions of those who seek to form coalitions with Israel. Right after his plane touched down in the occupied territories, Biden reaffirmed his advocacy of Zionism. He also doubled down on Washington's strong military support for Israel and the strong bonds between Americans and Israelis. This is the first leg of Biden's three-day visit, which will also take him to Saudi Arabia. Biden is facing criticism over the U.S. inaction, told Tel Aviv and Riyadh accountable for their killing of journalists Shirin Abu Akleh and Jamal Khashoggi. The U.S. government's latest data shows inflation in the country reached a new 40-year high in June. According to the Labor Department, the Consumer Price Index was at 9.1% last month. That's higher than U.S. officials had expected and is the fastest increase in four decades. Energy prices also posted their biggest annual rise in more than 40 years. Many Americans are blaming the U.S. monetary policies and the current administration's mismanagement for the high inflation.
No, I don't think the government's done a good job because all last year this began and they did nothing because they thought it was temporary. And, you know, during the pandemic, everybody got passed out money, including stores and all of that. And so it's like too much money floating around. They were very late to the game.
Well, I think the Federal Reserve said it was temporary, so I think maybe we could blame the Fed more than we can blame President Biden. They kept saying it was temporary for quite a while, and they finally had to change their tune.
Following the release of the data, President Joe Biden acknowledged that the inflation rate is unacceptably high. Still, he argued that the figure is out of date and does not reflect a clear drop in energy prices since mid-June. The central bank last month implemented the biggest interest rate hike in nearly 30 years to rein in the inflation, but so far that has not been effective. Earlier in our news review program, we discussed revelations by a former senior U.S. official about America's involvement in coup plots in foreign countries. Here's what our guests had to say. On this segment of the program, a well-recognized face in U.S. politics has admitted to helping plan attempted foreign coups in unprecedented remarks, openly acknowledging Washington's role in stoking unrest in other countries. John Bolton was talking to CNN after a hearing of a congressional committee investigating last year's deadly attack on the Capitol building. The assault is seen as the culmination of an attempted coup orchestrated by ex-President Donald Trump in a bid to remain in power after losing the 2020 election. His national security advisor disagrees that Trump was competent to pull off a coup. Bolton has, however, acknowledged his own involvement in masterminding coups in other countries.
One doesn't have to be brilliant to attempt a coup.
I disagree with that. As somebody who has helped plan coup d'etat,
yeah,
not here, but, you know, other places, it takes a lot of work.
I do want to ask a follow-up. When we were talking about what is capable, what you need to do to be able to plan a coup, and you cited your expertise having planned coups.
I'm not going to get into the specifics, but...
Successful coups?
Well, I wrote about Venezuela in the book, and it turned out not to be successful. Not that we had all that much to do with it, but I saw what it took for an opposition to try and overturn an illegally elected president, and they failed.
In 2019, Bolton publicly supported Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido's call for the military to line up behind him to oust Nicolas Maduro, arguing that the president's re-election was fraudulent. The efforts, however, ended unsuccessfully. Many foreign policy experts have slammed Washington over its history of interventions in other countries. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have Director of Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, Tim Anderson, who's with us from Sydney. Also, we have political analyst Barry Grossman joining us from Bali. And let's jump right in there. What do you make of the recent comments made by John Bolton and the rather public confession on national television?
Well, we have to remember that John Bolton is part of the faction in Washington, which is sometimes called realists, sometimes Republicans, where they speak rather more openly about their interventions and wars and crimes overseas, as opposed to the liberal faction, which tries to put a nicer image on it of humanitarian intervention and human rights and so on. So Bolton, of course, was deeply responsible for the fabrication of evidence in relation to the invasion of Iraq in 2003. He was involved in the attempts, several attempts, to have a coup in Venezuela. He was also, as ambassador to the UN, responsible for covering up the crimes of apartheid Israel in the expansion of settlements and the massacre of Palestinians. There's a whole series of crimes that Bolton's been involved with, and this is not unique that he's admitting openly his involvement.
And Barry Grossman, give us your thoughts on what John Bolton just said.
Well, look, it's interesting to reflect on what he said and why he said it, because it certainly wasn't in any way directly germane to the issue being discussed, namely the January 6th protesters, which are now being characterized variously as people who engaged in a rebellion or even an attempted coup d'etat at President Trump's instigation. And it's important to remember that John Bolton, even though he's a leading neoconservative, he's very much a second-tier neocon, and I think that troubles him a lot. I think he would like to be thought of as one of the leading top-tier neocons, and he's not. So he makes these comments as if he sees it as a way to elevate himself and his importance, when it doesn't do that. But as for the substance of what he said, I think it's pretty clear that the U.S. has a long sordid history of being involved in orchestrating coup d'etats around the world, that in recent years, the last couple of decades, to be sure, the neocons have been very active in fomenting coup d'etats. We see the consequences of that right now in the Ukraine, for example. And so when he admits to having been involved in planning coup d'etats abroad, it's worth considering what was playing out when he was a senior member of the Trump administration.
Tim Anderson, looking at some of the reactions, basically everybody believes that this has happened before by Washington. It's going to happen again. The question is, will Washington and the United States ever be held to account for their actions?
Yes, well, the habitual nature of it is to do, of course, with the fact that there's a de facto impunity to U.S. crimes around the world. And one of the few exceptions, perhaps, has been the treatment of Mike Pompeo recently, where it's well known now that Iran is after him for responsibility for the murder of General Soleimani, for example, and there's also he's wanted for questioning in Spain too. That's a very rare occasion. Generally speaking, figures in the U.S. can make these sort of statements, admitting their involvement. Let's remember, it's not just about coups; it's about murdering human beings, murdering sometimes thousands and sometimes tens of thousands of human beings, and get away with it. Where is the accountability? Who is going to stand up to them? And I think that's what it comes down to. It will keep on going so long as there is this impunity, so long as there is not a strong state or group of states which say this is enough, we have to hold these individuals accountable.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Director of Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, Tim Anderson, joining us from Sydney, and thanks to political analyst Barry Grossman, joining us from Bali. With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review, but do stay tuned. There's plenty more to come here. Construction workers turn out in several cities across Panama to show that they're fed up with an inflation rate that's going through the roof. Union members took part in massive protests paralyzing the streets in the capital, Panama City. They accused the government of robbing the poor to feed the rich. Wednesday's demonstration followed weeks of angry protests in the Central American nation. In recent weeks, protesters have spilled out into the streets, erecting roadblocks to demand a halt to rising fuel and food costs. They also want the government to curb public spending, with the exception of education, as consumers are bearing the brunt of these steadily creeping prices. The government has announced price controls for some food items, along with some austerity measures to curb inflation, but the demonstrations continue regardless. Panama is not the only country bordering the Caribbean Sea that's plagued by protests. Haiti is also witnessing a wave of unrest as anger mounts over fuel shortages. Protesters blocked roads in the capital, Port-au-Prince. Gas stations across the country are mostly closed in light of a turf war between rival gangs near one of Haiti's major fuel terminals. The week of gang violence in Port-au-Prince has left some 90 people dead, accelerating a downward spiral in the security situation. Political unrest and violence rocked Haiti a year ago when its president was gunned down at his residence. But the country's politics continue to be in a state of disarray, with the office of the president still vacant, a short-staffed and ill-equipped police force that is unable to control the street gangs has worsened the situation. The European Commission admits its current strategy to compensate for reduced energy supplies from Russia is inadequate. The surging oil and gas prices in the EU resulting from sanctions imposed on Moscow contributing to economic turmoil across the 27-country bloc. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
Europe is currently experiencing a heat wave. It means that overall energy consumption is lower than usual. However, winter is fast approaching. The EU has cut energy imports from Russia in retaliation for the war in Ukraine. The bloc has agreed deals with the US, Norway and Qatar to import liquefied natural gas.
Is this enough? No, I don't think it is enough. And this is the reason why on July the 20th we will come with further proposals.
If these proposals fall short, the EU faces a major energy crisis this winter. Economists are already painting a very gloomy picture. Eurozone finance ministers claim all the blame rests with Moscow. Analysts say EU leaders are hurting their own citizens by placing enormous sanctions on Moscow. At the same time, Russia's economy seems to be performing well. Aside from soaring energy and food prices in the EU, there is worrying volatility in financial markets. The European Central Bank is raising interest rates. The euro is currently very weak, which has the effect of pushing up inflation even more. Croatia is due to become the 20th member of the Eurozone in January. The EU describes this as an historic step. The question is, will Croatians have much to celebrate by the time they start using the struggling euro? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Members of Congress will argue former US President Donald Trump's notorious "Be There, Will Be Wild" tweet was the catalyst for violent protests on 6th of January 2021. We're prepared for you an article written by Hugo Lowell. The piece is titled January 6 hearing to focus on Trump's tweet to extremist group. The House January 6 Select Committee is expected to make the case at its seventh hearing that Donald Trump gave the signal to the extremist groups that stormed the Capitol building to target and obstruct the congressional certification of Joe Biden's Electoral College win. According to sources close to the inquiry who spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss the forthcoming hearing, the House panel will zero in on pivotal tweets sent by the former President Donald Trump in the early hours of the morning on 19th of December 2020. Donald Trump said in the tweet, "Big protest in D.C. on 6th of January. Be there, will be wild." The Select Committee will say at the hearing, led by Congressman Jamie Raskin and Stephanie Murphy, that Trump's tweet was the catalyst that triggered the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers militia groups, as well as Stop the Steal activists to target the certification of Joe Biden's Electoral College win. And the Select Committee will say Donald Trump sent the tweet knowing that for those groups it amounted to a confirmation that they should put into motion their plans for 6th of January and encourage thousands of other supporters to also march on the Capitol for a protest. The House Select Committee will say the tweet was the pivotal moment in the timeline leading up to the Capitol attack, since it was from that point that the Proud Boys and Oath Keepers militias seriously started preparations and Stop the Steal started applying for permits. The Select Committee also currently plans to play video clips from former White House counsel Pat Cipollone's recent testimony to House investigators at his hearings. Congressman Jamie Raskin is expected to first touch on the immediate events before the tweet. A contentious White House meeting on 18th of December 2020, where Donald Trump weighed seizing voting machines and appointing conspiracy theorist Sidney Powell as special counsel to investigate so-called election fraud. The Guardian has reported the meeting involved Donald Trump and four informal advisers, including Donald Trump's ex-National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, former Trump campaign lawyer Sidney Powell, former Overstock CEO Patrick Byrne, and former Trump aide Emily Newman. Once in the Oval Office, they implored Donald Trump to invoke Executive Order 13848, which granted him emergency powers in the event of foreign interference in the election. Though that had not happened, to seize voting machines and install Sidney Powell as special counsel. The former president ultimately demurred on both of the proposals, but the Select Committee will say after the Flynn-Powell-Byrne-Newman plan for him to overturn the election fell apart, he turned his attention to 6th of January as his final chance and sent his tweet. The House panel will show the response to Donald Trump's tweet was direct and immediate, noting that Stop the Steal announced plans for a protest in Washington, set to coincide with Joe Biden's certification just hours after the former president sent his missive. According to federal prosecutors prosecuting the case, the Proud Boys militia, whose top members has since been indicted for seditious conspiracy over the Capitol attack, also started to crystallize what their plans were for 6th of January 2021, the following day. Prosecutors have said on 20th of December 2020, the former Proud Boys national chairman Enrique Tarrio created an encrypted group chat called MOSD Leaders Group, described by Enrique Tarrio as a national rally planning committee that included his top lieutenants. According to the wildprotest.com website, the day after Enrique Tarrio started the MOSD Leaders Group, the Monday after Donald Trump's tweet, that came on a Saturday, the leaders of Stop the Steal applied for a permit to stage a protest on Lot 8 near the Capitol and around that time. Citing the Proud Boys indictment, the House Select Committee will say, through the rest of December and spurred on by Donald Trump's tweet, the Proud Boy leaders used the MOSD chats to plan a Washington, D.C. trip and tell their members to dress incognito for their operation on 6th of January 2021. The House panel intends to show top members of the Oath Keepers militia group led by Stuart Rhodes, who have also been indicted for seditious conspiracy, made similar plans as they prepared to obstruct the congressional certification of Joe Biden's election win. The House Select Committee will then focus on how the Oath Keepers stockpiled weapons and created an armed quick reaction force ready to deploy to the Capitol, and how the group ended up as the security detail for far-right activist Roger Stone and other Trump allies. One of the witnesses providing public testimony at the hearing is expected to be Jason Van Tattenhove, a former spokesperson for the Oath Keepers, who left the group around 2017, but is slated to discuss their motivations and how they operated. The First Amendment Praetorian, Michael Flynn's paramilitary group, is also expected to get a brief mention at the hearing, as will the various war rooms at the Willard Hotel, where both Roger Stone and Michael Flynn, as well as Donald Trump's attorney, Rudy Giuliani, were spotted ahead of 6th of January 2021. The House Select Committee, through Jamie Raskin's portion of the hearing, will run through the effects of Donald Trump's tweet on preparations for January 6, right up until the morning of the Capitol attack and Donald Trump's speech at the Save America rally on the Ellipse. Congresswoman Murphy is then expected to examine the Ellipse rally itself and Donald Trump's incendiary rhetoric, where he told his supporters that he would march with them to the Capitol, giving the pro-Trump crowd the ultimate incentive to storm Joe Biden's certification. Furthermore, Donald Trump's former top strategist, Steve Bannon, suffered heavy setbacks in his contempt of Congress case on Monday, 11th of July, after a federal judge dismissed his motion to delay his trial, scheduled for next days, and ruled he could not make two of his principal defenses to a jury. The flurry of adverse rulings from District of Columbia District Judge Carl Nichols, a Trump appointee, marked a significant knockback for Steve Bannon, who was charged with criminal contempt after he ignored a subpoena last year from the House January 6 Select Committee. Judge Carl Nichols refused in federal court in Washington, D.C. to delay Steve Bannon's trial date set for next Monday, saying that he saw no reason to push back proceedings after he severely limited the defenses that the former Trump aide's lawyers could present to a jury. The defeats for Steve Bannon stunned his lead lawyer, David Schoen, who asked aghast, "What's the point of going to trial if we don't have any defenses?" Judge Carl Nichols stripped Steve Bannon of two of his main defenses for defying the House Select Committee's subpoena, ruling he could not present evidence to the jury that he had relied on the advice of counsel, and could not rely on entrapment by estoppel. The argument that the defendant was advised erroneously by an official that certain conduct was legal. Judge Carl Nichols said the decision came in large part because he was bound by the controlling case law at the Washington, D.C. circuit level, which ruled in Licavoli v. United States, 1961. That advice of counsel was no defense against contempt of Congress charges. Judge Carl Nichols also rejected Steve Bannon's claims that He thought his non-compliance was excused by executive privilege and narrowed the arguments Bannon could present to maintain whether he was aware of the deadlines for testimony and producing documents established by the House Select Committee.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The horrors of the U.S.-led war in Afghanistan continues to make news, even after the U.S.'s disastrous pullout. The report has revealed that unarmed Afghan men were routinely shot by U.K.'s elite forces during nighttime raids during this long war, and weapons were planted on them to justify their crimes. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why there has not been an apology from the U.K. government, even though it has a lame duck prime minister, and we also examine whether this behavior is part of the protocol of U.K.'s army in how it conducts itself on the battlefield.
In a damning report, BBC has revealed that British Special Air Service, SAS, unlawfully killed 54 civilians in the Afghan province of Helmand from 2010 to 2011. The report reveals that senior British officers, including the head of UK Special Forces, were aware of the crimes, but did not report them to military police.
Afghanistan had been the best backyard of the West during past decades. They committed any war crimes they could and violated every rule. Our country was used as the best scene of examining arms and training armies. All NATO forces, including Britain's, were largely involved in scandals. This as they were not being held accountable by any courts. I hope BBC's new report is not a media game only, and it will be followed by a judicial process.
The victims of the 20-year war and Afghan advocates are demanding compensation and accountability for their losses.
There are a lot of helpless women and children in Afghanistan whose lives were devastated as a result of the U.S. and allies' war crimes in our country. Some have lost their fathers and some their breadwinners. Today, they are left on the streets without food or shelter. We urge the U.N. and those institutions who claim to be the human rights champions to hold the international criminal accountable and help suffering families with compensation.
Previously, dozens of reports were published revealing the scandals and killings by other NATO troops, including American and Australian forces. In total, more than 46,000 Afghan civilians were killed from 2001 to 2021. Afghans are angry over NATO's two decades of destruction in their country. They're also calling for justice for hundreds of civilians who were killed by the U.S.-led coalition's forces during their presidency in Afghanistan. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Scott Bennett joins us. He's a former U.S. Army psychological warfare officer who joins us from San Francisco. Also joining us is Vladimir Goldstein, associate professor of Slavic studies at Brown University in Rhode Island.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests
from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of this story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Scott Bennett, first to you. What are your thoughts on SAS operatives in Afghanistan repeatedly, from what we understand of this report, killing detainees and unarmed men? It was reported it was in suspicious circumstances, and this was an investigation that was led by the government-funded channel, the BBC of the UK.
Well, the entire Afghan theater, the entire Afghanistan war was a war crime, is a war crime, and should be prosecuted as a war crime. The American people, the British people, the world, in fact, were lied to in this artificially generated false flag attack on 9/11 that was pre-planned. And the reason that Afghanistan was invaded was because of the opium poppy fields that the CIA had been trafficking in for over 30 years. And the rare earth minerals that Britain and the New World Order and the United States wanted to rape and pillage and harvest. So that was the real purpose for invading Afghanistan, not because any silly notions of terrorism. All of that was a fraud. Tim Osman, the former CIA operative, also known as Osama bin Laden, was revealed as the excuse, but that was quickly revealed as a fraud. So the entire Afghanistan operation was a fraud, but the particular aspects of the murders, the assassinations, the cold-blooded killing of the SAS services, which are the equivalent of the U.S. Special Forces services, that is part and parcel of what the U.S. and the U.K. Military do. It's tragic that the military were, of course, lied to and told all of these horrendous, nightmarish stories of propaganda that fueled their animosity and their aggression, that no doubt the soldiers were completely lied to by many politicians, many cabinet members, many senior officers. So they certainly should prosecute the high-level officers and politicians that have presented this propaganda that goaded and animated these soldiers to do these crimes. And it should be investigated. And it's funny and tragic at the same time that the only moral military example that you can see in the modern world is Russia, that went into Ukraine to alleviate the rape and pillage of the Eastern Ukrainian people, the Eastern Russian people. Uh-huh. The Russian military stepped in to save them. And the Russian military has not been doing any of these war crimes, any of these murders in the military in the middle of the night, any of these destruction of civilian facilities.
Well, Vladimir Goldstein, one of the units, as it was reported there, and I emphasize the word just one, said that they were responsible for the killing of 54 people during a six-month tour, okay? Now, you have this occurring, and you have SAS troops that at the same time have planted weapons, I guess, on them to justify the crimes. How can it be, then, that if they have done this, I'm sure other officers or compatriots or their fellow, officers were aware of what was going on? Why didn't this piece of news then spread and make it out in the open in order for there to be some kind of first highlight and then a follow-through investigation in order for there to be accountability at the end?
Well, we're dealing clearly with a sort of double standard. When every absolutely unproven crime, unproven event is always blamed on particular groups of people who are demonized, be it Russia, be it Iran, be it Chinese. These are the guys who do all the crimes according to Western media. They commit all the atrocities. They inhumane. They bomb the cities. They bomb indiscriminately, as opposed to the Western, soldiers who behave like, holier than thou. This is obviously a lie, but this lie is being repeated again and again and again. We know, from the way Americans behaved in Vietnam, when they would destroy the villages and claiming that they are trying to save them. I don't think anybody is above a reproach. War is war. War is an ugly thing. And, a lot of soldiers probably lose their cool. Of course, what's important to stress is special forces are supposed to be cooler than others. And they, of all people, they are not just regular soldiers who were told some stories and go on rampage. They should know better. So this is absolutely unacceptable. And Great Britain shouldn't sit on it. But the bigger picture is that Great Britain shouldn't go around the world pointing to other countries' crimes when they themselves are very actively involved. Just the other day I read in BBC, Ukraine counted 21,000 war crimes committed by Russia. So, like, BBC already counting Russian crimes, while, it took them 10 or 12 years to figure out this one, which was staring straight at their face. And this is just totally kind of discouraging, basically, what an average person should think about this war, when one side is always lying and always blaming another one.
Well, Scott Bennett, you have a senior officer, and he's given testimonials on this. First, he said that too many people were being killed, and he said that shouldn't happen when people are detained. Within the context of this report of this officer testifying, it really wasn't a testimonial. He was just making comments on this. He said that also within that report, he didn't say there was a line or two on how the bullets, in terms of the way that they went into the body, showed that the Afghans who were detained were on their knees. They were lower in their height than the person standing. And then the same UK officer saying for it to happen over and over again was causing alarm at HQ. Now, I'm guessing HQ means headquarters, and I'm guessing that means what? Headquarters in London or headquarters at the army barracks? Because then that shows that the higher echelons of this were aware of this. So what happens once they're aware of this these crimes being committed?
Well, that's exactly right. This is the indication and the proof and the evidence of a bloodthirsty murder squad. It is not special forces that are liberating oppressed people and lifting up those liberated people to pursue happy, healthy, productive lives. This is a murder squad. This is a military indoctrinated agenda to go in and commit the exact executions that the Ukrainians, by the way, were doing to Russian prisoners of war. These people that the UK troops, and I might add also the United States troops, have done this before, where they by the trajectory of the bullet, is forensically determined that the person was executed while in custody on the ground or on their knees. We've seen also American soldiers being executed by our own corrupt soldiers because they were getting in the way of the military-industrial complex. And that really is a big part of what fuels a lot of this, the military-industrial complex. So all of this needs to be brought up at an international level. All of it can never be forgotten. And it's also a sign of why Britain in particular, and why Boris Johnson was thrown out of office, but Britain in particular and its military and the West is so obsessed with trying to shift the world's attention off of their crimes in Afghanistan and Iraq, as well as Syria, as well as Libya. Okay. As Yemen, they're trying to shift it to Ukraine and create a new bad guy. But the world is seeing all of the 20 years of these sort of crimes and murders and assassinations and stealing of resources and political chaos.
Right.
All of the world is now coming to the summary judgment that the West, in particular the United States and Great Britain, are more murderous, thuggish cults rather than liberators of oppressed peoples and builders of healthy nations.
Okay, I need to take and ask you just to give us a few short sentences on something you said there, Scott Bennett, which, if I heard you correctly, you said that even U.S. soldiers did not have mercy on U.S. soldiers who were getting in the way. Can you elaborate on that for us so we can have another program, perhaps, a full program to dedicate to that?
Pat Tillman was a special forces soldier that went in to the Rangers when he was a football player, and he was executed. And the body forensic analysis showed that he had been shot with a machine gun fire by a U.S. machine gun, not a Kalashnikov. I've talked to investigators and lawyers that were looking into that. Numerous other U.S. soldiers, such as myself, were imprisoned, were blackballed, were kicked out of the military, were reprimanded when we were exposing the CIA bringing briefcases of cash in Iraq and exposing that it was just being doled out.
Sure.
I know soldiers that were kicked out and in some cases executed
right.
Because they get in the way of the military-industrial complex. And that's at the heart of this corruption and death. The soldiers are wrong to do the murdering, but what's even more wrong are the politicians and the senior officers that indoctrinate these young soldiers.
Indeed.
With this murderous agenda.
Indeed. Thank you so much for that. Back to the topic now, which maybe in a sense is indirectly related, but to our shock, Vladimir Goldstein, there has been other indications that have happened on this scale, perhaps even bigger. One report indicating in 24, this is not a report, this is a Royal Military Police that launched an investigation back in 2014 in which there were 600 alleged offenses that were committed by the British forces in Afghanistan, which included some of the killings. Some of the killings included the SAS squadron. But then it says the RMP investigators told the BBC that they were obstructed by the British military. So that seems to me like it's a concerted effort to cover this up.
Yeah, this is an ugly story, and I want to return to what Scott mentioned, is that the whole war was ugly. And I think, you know, the soldiers, even a good soldier, something which once on the ground, it's kind of, you know, greedy and so on, they lose their morale. They probably start taking drugs. They got cynical and discouraged. And then they end up, you know, committing, you know, murders, blatant murders, totally kind of cynical murders. And then it ends up being covered up. It's not like, you know, Brits were fighting for their independence from Hitler's bombing or something. They were in the wrong country where they didn't know what they're fighting for. And I think that's an inevitable result. And we see it's happening here and there. But what is interesting, it's all accompanied by absolute barrage of lies, because it's all only the other side commits crimes. We remember how the first war against Iraq, you know, in defense of Kuwait started. They came up with this stupid idea of, like, Iraqi forces rape babies, take them from incubators. All just only they do all this crime. But our forces and then our forces come over there and destroy cities, kill half a million, you know, soldiers. So that type of propaganda is really, really unpleasant. And, you know, until the, you know, consumers of the news continue to buy into this simplistic bipolar world where the enemies of Anglo-Saxon empires are all evil and vicious and pull babies out of incubators while we British soldiers are just squeaky clean, and that lies will continue and the wars will continue.
Well, Scott,
and let me just add the Kuwaiti ambassador's daughter was the woman who appeared to the Congress and made those lies about babies being thrown out of incubators. That was the Central Intelligence of the United States engineering a lie to speak to the American Congress through the Kuwaiti ambassador's daughter, and the British were fully on board with that and were telling the same lies through Tony Blair and their own cabinet ministers. So this is a perfect example of your other guest identified, dating all the way back to the 1990-1991 first Gulf War. And it has only gotten progressively worse as the West has progressively degenerated into an almost subhuman military industrial conquest juggernaut of destruction that hopefully the world is finally ostracizing and rejecting. And I think they're looking at Russia as a replacement because of the more moral and intelligent character and expressions, as well as Iran, that's coming out from a new emerging world order that pulls us away from the old world order, which for 20 years has been built on the bones and the blood and the fire and the destruction of lives and systems of government and civilization.
Well, I would think along those lines, Scott Bennett, as you just mentioned, and you did mention before, that this, in a sense, presents itself an opportunity in order for these crimes to be exposed. Of course, it's so sad that Afghanistan was the ground of which, maybe according to a playbook shared by both the UK and U.S. operatives, that they did and commit these types of crimes. And to parallel that or compare that to what's going on in Ukraine, where it's no secret, I'm sure you know, that the U.S. has said we will fight the Russians until the last Ukrainian standing. But in this case, are we seeing any light in terms of more exposure of what's happening. I mean, well, you know, Press TV does that, but I mean, it should be on a more massive scale so the world is, you know, aware that this is going on.
That's the problem. The world isn't aware it's going on because the British media and the United States media have all conspired to do nothing but advance the political agenda and speaking points of the government power. Boris Johnson, Joe Biden, Victoria Nuland, all of these people were instrumental in the original conquest of Ukraine, the coup d'etat, the overthrowing of Yanukovych, the planting of the chemical bioweapons labs, which are now being linked to COVID-19, which came out of Wuhan, but before it went to Fort Detrick, and before Detrick, it was linked to the bioweapons labs in Ukraine. So the United States is responsible, I would say, for the COVID-19 biological development. But the world is waking up and seeing the fraud and hypocrisy that is that is being manifested.
All right,
the West.
Let me give Vladimir Goldstein the final question here. I'm almost at a loss to ask this question because it sounds like I shouldn't even bother. But under UK law, from what I'm reading, governing the armed forces is a criminal offense for a commanding officer to fail to inform the military police if they become aware of potential war crimes. It sounds like they did commit war crimes intentionally, but of course there's a law out there. Why then not act on this law now that some of these exposures have happened? In less than a minute, please.
Well, you know, the army, like any other institution, try to protect their own. Remember, like the very courageous lieutenant in the American army, which tried to stop this My Lai massacre. I think he was actually charged. The person who was supposed to stop it was charged. So I don't expect. I don't have high hopes about Great Britain. They might accuse someone just to slap on the wrist, but their lies and their, you know, kind of we are better than that will continue. And
thank you.
Will definitely continue, as we see example from Ukraine. This is the same thing which was done in Kuwait, but even on a greater scale.
Thank you so much for that, Vladimir Goldstein, Associate Professor of Slavic Studies, Brown University, Scott Bennett. Thank you, former U.S. Army Psychological Warfare Officer from San Francisco. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitapwe and the team, this is goodbye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Supplication is the wealth of the believer and the bridge by which one achieves proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Exalted.
A path to salvation, a way to connect the two worlds. On the program, Bridge.
You're listening to the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Al-Musavi. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته and welcome to IRIB English Radio and you are listening to the program Bridge and we are looking at supplication number 8 found in الصحيفة السجادية for الإمام علي بن الحسين زين العابدين عليه سلام الله Imam al-Sajjad was asking Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and he was seeking refuge in him from shakasatul akhlaq, bad morals and bad ethics. We spoke about bad morals and bad ethics. Now we're looking at the opposite to that, which is good morals and good ethics. On the day of judgment, me and you, we will face Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala whether we like it or not, sooner or later. And when people come to Allah, they come with their sahaf. They will come with their books in their hands or at least chained to their necks. As the Quran says, وَكُلُّ إِنسَانٍ أَلْزَمْنَاهُ طَائِرُهُ فِي عُنُقِهِ Every human will come with his book attached to his neck. This sahifa, this book, it has a title. Each person will come with his book and it has its own title on it. Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, he says to us that the title of the sahifa, of the book of the believer, the mu'min, he says, عنوانو صحيفة المؤمن حسن الخلق. The head, the title, or the head title of the book of the believer is good morals and good akhlaq. So imagine you turn to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala with your book and the title and the heading on the cover says, حسن الخلق, that you had the best of morality. مؤمنين, they need to have that title. Stay with us. We'll come back, inshallah. ربنا ربنا
A path to salvation. A way to connect the two worlds.
The bridge between Allah and His creation.
A bridge that is meant to take us to Allah, to take us to His proximity. A bridge that is in the form of dua and supplication.
In this program, we offer commentary on the du'as of As-Sahifatu Sajjadiyah of Imam Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam.
The famous book of litanies, the Psalms of Islam.
Bridge.
Rabbana, Rabbana,
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program Bridge coming to you from IRIB English Radio. So we said before the break that the title of the book of the believer on Day of Judgment is Husnul Khuluq, the best of akhlaq, the best of morals and best of ethics. There's a beautiful hadith from Imam al-Hasan al-Mujtaba alayhi salam, and it's funny that this hadith was narrated by al-Hasan al-Basri. So Hassan al-Basri narrates from Imam al-Hasan alayhi salam. And the hadith says, أحسن الحسن الخلق الحسن. So there are the hadith itself and the chain of narratives, they all have the word Hassan in it, which is quite beautiful to see. He says, the best of the best is al-khulq al-hasan, that having the best of akhlaq. So there's all best everywhere. So even Imam al-Hasan alayhi salam, he says, the best thing a person could have in this life and in the hereafter is in fact in his akhlaq. And when it comes to his akhlaq, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will give him so much in terms of day of judgment and so much in this world as well. Now, amongst the things that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will give a believer in this world is that he will be content, he will be happy. A hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen says, أَرْضَ النَّاسِ, the most pleased amongst the people, من كانت أخلاقه رضية, he who his akhlaq are pleasing. So if you have a pleasing akhlaq, that people get pleased with it, you'll be the most pleased person on earth. You'll be content, happy. Why? Because everyone is happy with you. When everyone is upset or everyone angry or no one likes you, you won't be happy, will you? Obviously not. So Imam Ali alayhi salam says, those who have the best of akhlaq, they'll be content. They'll be happy, pleased in this world. Again, the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wasallam says, حُسْنُ الْخُلُقِ يُثَبِّتُ الْمَوَدَّةِ Having best of akhlaq, makes people love you. Not just love you, the Prophet says, yuthabbit. It firms and confirms the love, your love, in people's hearts. People become not only pleasing with you, but in fact, they become in love with you. Why? Because of your good manners and your good akhlaq. So you can see the effects of your akhlaq in this world before the next. Let us take a short break and then we will continue.